BCFM 93.2.
Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated? With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Our local protection racket, so we better be nice to them. NATO descend on Newport for their annual conference. Those lovely NATO types bring with them a severe threat level and a 10-mile ring of steel. And, yes, so they are the toughest gang in the world. Well, we'll be talking about them and their political lobby, the Bilderberg Conferences, which is just been revealed this week, will be taking place in Austria next year. Plus, the NHS's blacklist of health workers who may never work again because they've brought up patient safety matters with their bosses. Does the culture of shut your mouth and do what you're told work in our clinics and our hospitals? Or is this just more of the culture of bullying and secrecy? The two merchant venturer bosses, that's John Savage and Peter Rillett, Bristol NHS have brought in. From the business world. Plus Martin Summers' tour of the world's hotspots, including, no doubt, Ukraine this week, with talks of the Russian army moving around in eastern Ukraine. But we start this week by looking at the child abuse. This week, yes, another one. South Yorkshire have released a report that 1,200 underage young people have been sexually exploited. But the police nor social services have done anywhere near enough about it. Is Britain now officially the child abuse capital of the world? Or are we just the only country with the courage to acknowledge and deal with this problem? Well, to discuss that and other things, I'm joined on the line by the former Senator, Stuart Siveray from Jersey. Hi, Stuart, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you come across child abuse in Jersey with the Hope de la Garenne scandal there?
Well, it wasn't just Hope de la Garenne. There were a number of very serious child protection failings in Jersey. The kind of way I evolved into the position is that I was from outside of the Jersey establishment, really. I'm an ordinary working person. I got elected at quite a young age, at the age of 25. And in spite of the best efforts of Jersey's establishment, I was succeeding politically. And I eventually ended up becoming the president of the island's Health and Social Services Committee and then the Minister for Health and Social Services. And I had that position for several years. And what happened was towards the end of 2006, a number of whistleblowers began to approach me, frontline staff initially, then other witnesses, then victims of different examples of child abuse. And this was deeply concerning to me, so I began inquiring into it myself in late 2006 and early 2007. And I obviously began to ask questions of my very senior staff, the senior managers, the relevant executives of the department. And what evolved over a period of several months is that it became clear that I was being overtly and extremely seriously lied to by the senior management, who were simply telling complete falsehoods to me and actually striving to cover up what was a systemic and endemic long-term catalogue of child protection failure.
Could you just give us an example of the sort of thing that a whistleblower would come to you with and then the replies that you would get from your officials?
Oh, certainly. For example, up until the end of 2006, children with mental health issues were being essentially arrested and jailed in the island's child secure unit. And any kind of problematic behaviour, which obviously these kind of children invariably had, would be punished with lengthy regimes of solitary confinement. And this went on in some cases for months. Essentially, mentally ill children at the age of 13, 14, 15 were being held in solitary confinement regimes for weeks and months at a stretch in essentially concrete cells and not allowed to mingle with other children. Now, this was simply grotesque, absolutely abominable. It was child abuse, of course, in itself, and it was illegal. And I was simply lied to and told a variety of falsehoods by the senior managers in connection with that issue when I was trying to expose it. Eventually, the whistleblowers and I were exonerated by a fully independent report from the Howard League for Penal Reform. But essentially, what happened was that in July 2007, I made my concerns public when answering a question in the Jersey Parliament. And this led, although I didn't know it at that time, to a wholly illegal conspiracy of senior civil servants from Jersey's public sector and the Crown officers, advised by the then Attorney General, to essentially engineer my dismissal as minister because I was exposing these child protection failings.
Well, that's interesting, because we're just talking about, in a few minutes, the similar kind of thing going on in the National Health Service, where whistleblowers are being dismissed, other things are being found, turning it into an employment issue, and they got out of the way so that the problems that they're raising within the health service are not dealt with, and then that person will go onto a blacklist. But tell us about these Crown agents. How do things work down in Jersey? Because I imagine it's one step removed from the British mainland government.
Well, the actual way power works in Jersey is very, very strange. It essentially is the power of the Crown in a much more intense and direct way than perhaps you would be used to in the UK, where you have the constitutional monarchy. Power in the Crown dependencies, those are the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, is still very much influenced directly by the Crown and the monarchy itself. And the actual real officers of power in Jersey, the Solicitor General, Attorney General, Deputy Bailiff, Bailiff and Lieutenant Governor, are all appointed directly and expressly by the Crown. They are empowered via what is called letters patent, given to them by the monarch. So essentially those public officers, those Crown officers, in truth wield all meaningful power in Jersey. And it's especially difficult because Jersey has no functioning fourth estate. There's a lot of media in Jersey for the size of the island, but all of the mainstream media is owned and run by the local establishment, and the only effective media that's done the necessary investigative journalism in Jersey over the last 4, 5 or 6 years have been the bloggers, people like Voice for Children, Rico Sorda, and myself, Stuart Sivray, on the what is now the Free Speech Offshore blog. So we are effectively challenging not only the obviously dangerous and deficient public authorities in Jersey, we're also having to fight against a wholly overtly complicit local mainstream media.
Okay, so how did this did you first hear about the allegations of abuse at Haute de la Garenne, and what then transpired?
Well, I heard some rumours about Haute de la Garenne and some stories, but I mean, essentially Haute de la Garenne had closed in 1986, so the cases relating to that place were old, but still obviously very, very important. And it was actually mainly the States of Jersey Police Force under the then leadership, the good leadership of Graham Power, the Chief Police Officer, and Lenny Harper, the Deputy Chief Police Officer. They looked into the Haute de la Garenne case in particular, and they began a covert investigation, which quite purely by coincidence paralleled my own investigations as minister into the more recent and other examples of abuse which happened across a variety of institutions in Jersey. I mean, people might remember the controversy, and that kind of rumbled on from 2007 and into 2008. But at the end of 2008, the police chief, Graham Power, was illegally suspended in what was plainly just a criminal conspiracy by the island's government and the Crown officers. And, you know, these are the kind of problems we deal with in Jersey. There is no functioning checks and balances. For example, a former senior investigating officer, the deputy chief officer of the police, Lenny Harper, has said in an interview that there are at least 4 priority abuse suspects still in positions of power and influence and public authority in Jersey. So these are the kind of issues we have to deal with. And it's not only our view. I mean, for example, the Leeds businessman Ken Bates, you know, quite a well-known figure, recently was interviewed on radio in the United Kingdom about an absolutely appalling series of years he's had to fight a legal case in Jersey, a business-related case. And he has said simply that the judicial system in Jersey is basically dysfunctional and corrupt. And it is. It's wholly politicised, and it is the entity through which power is abused.
Okay, it's also known, very well known, as a tax haven. Maybe not necessarily so well known as a place to drugs are brought in and out of the United Kingdom. But Stuart, what would you say about the possible links between some of the abuse you're saying, you know, senior people in the Jersey government being criminals, and the fact that it's actually a tax haven too, and this link really with the direct control by the Crown? I think it's just interesting to see how you think those actual power structures work, and I suppose if there's any kind of real thought about reforming them.
Obviously some of us want to reform the situation in Jersey, because all power in Jersey is, to all practical intents and purposes, in the hands of the Crown officers, and the democracy such as it is in Jersey is essentially a charade. It's a Potemkin village, much indeed as the prosecution and the judicial functions are. And for example, in the course of 2008, when the child abuse investigations were at their height, the sole prosecuting authority in Jersey, the Crown-appointed Attorney General, was known to be associating with certain priority abuse suspects. And naturally enough, that sole prosecutor then decided not to have them charged or prosecuted. Now, people in Jersey have got no recourse over this. Those people, the Attorney General, Solicitor General, Bailiff, Deputy Bailiff, Lieutenant Governor, are appointed directly by London. Now, I and other people have made numerous complaints to the authorities in London, the Crown, the Privy Council and the Secretary of State for Justice, because they do have ultimate constitutional and legal responsibility for good governance and the proper rule of law in Jersey. Our complaints are invariably ignored. We don't even get faintly credible answers. The situation in Jersey is that the apparatus here, as it were, this kind of fake democracy and this fake lawful jurisdiction, is protected by the powers that be in London. It suits London, and it suits the City of London Corporation to have this kind of status quo in Jersey, where things might look nice and quaint and respectable on the surface, but if you delve underneath it, of course, you find massive dysfunction. Now, obviously, the City of London Corporation is a quite strange and archaic little enclave in itself. It has peculiar constitutional rights and powers.
Yeah, it's a bit like a state within its state, and I think I'm right in saying that even the Queen has to ask permission if she wants to visit the City of London.
That's absolutely correct. The actual British monarch is, in certain important ways, actually subservient to and is an agent of the City of London Corporation. And that is actually laid down in Magna Carta, and it's one of the few actually remaining existing clauses in Magna Carta that remains actually in force rather than being superseded by modern legislation. Now, Jersey is essentially the City of London's kind of offshore backyard. It's kind of boiler house where things are perhaps even a bit too dodgy in legal and constitutional and international financial and legal terms to do in the City of London kind of get done in Jersey. The city boys have an expression, Jersey or jail. So the stuff that they do for their international clients, you know, these are the big accountancy firms, the bankers, the big legal practices that exist in London, anything that's a bit too dodgy even for them to do there, gets done via Jersey. And obviously the lobby that we face is simply insurmountable. The local media in Jersey is owned by these people, so it's immensely difficult to compete against it. Only us bloggers have ever tried to do that. And the real power that could intervene to clean up Jersey and fix this place and give us something like an independent, you know, proper judiciary and a proper prosecution system, that power resides in London. But of course, that power is under the immense influence of the City of London Corporation and all of the various politicians.
But Stuart, you are officially, surely you're part of the European Union. Can't you appeal to Brussels?
Well, we're not actually part of the European Union. Jersey is not a member of the EU. So appealing to Brussels doesn't so much enter the equation, although Jersey is actually bound by the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the fundamental instrument of the Council of Europe, which is a different, a broader body of states than the European Union. But our difficulty is, if you take a case to the European Court of Human Rights, that institution will only look at broad fundamental principles. It will not and does not delve into the details.
So you're banging your head against a brick wall in Brussels as well. But what does the your experience, because we've had since the Haute de la Garenne scandal in Jersey, we've had all sorts of other of these abuse scandals going on. I mean, the most notable, obviously, is the Jimmy Savile scandal, which is also, funnily enough, linked to the royal family, as Savile was very friendly, particularly with Prince Charles. And what does that... those other scandals, what do you think you've seen that, you know, that you can throw some light on what's been happening here? Because I heard you talk about having real problems with the media there, not being able to get your voice heard as much as you'd like on the Jersey media in order to, I suppose, to create a kind of atmosphere where it's something is done about criminals who are still in power. But of course, Savile was very, very loved, supposedly, anyway, at the BBC. So he, it seems, was very, very clever at getting into the media here. Now, I just wonder what you think, what you felt when you saw this scandal unfolding here in Britain of somebody that had been supposedly embraced by the whole society, including Margaret Thatcher, the NSPCC, and the BBC. It suddenly turns out to be the biggest abuser that the country's ever known.
Well, I was aware of certain abuse instances committed by Jimmy Savile, because he actually came to Jersey very often and was strongly connected to the island. So I was aware that there were victims of Savile in Jersey. So when that story erupted, it didn't come wholly surprising to me, although the sheer scale and nature of the depravity of this individual obviously was simply breathtaking. But of course, it's an illustration, isn't it, of the fact that these people, when they've got these kind of connections with the media, with the BBC, for example, and Savile had good, strong links, you know, with the BBC in Jersey, and the BBC in Jersey have been atrocious, I'm afraid, in helping to expose these issues and providing any kind of balance. But yes, it's absolutely remarkable. I mean, Savile came to Jersey a lot. He had a lot of connections here with local people and with the BBC in Jersey. He committed acts of abuse here. It's been suggested that he engaged in necrophilia and abusing people with mental health issues in certain institutions in the United Kingdom. Now, I was in charge of Jersey's Health and Social Services Department, and if you were to say to me, could I guarantee you that Savile didn't commit such acts against, well, corpses or mentally ill adults in Jersey, frankly, no, I couldn't. And if it emerged that he had acted in that way in Jersey, I wouldn't be in the least surprised.
So do you think we've got anything in the wider UK, in Westminster, London, in Britain, to learn from your experience in Jersey?
I think the situation is well illustrated by looking at the Savile case, actually. I mean, who would have believed, you know, had you written this before, that this man had these hundreds and thousands of victims and so many people were aware of it?
But even when the Newsnight reporter managed to get people on camera who'd been abused by him, Peter Rippon, the Newsnight editor, said, oh, we're not going to run that because we've got a Jimmy Savile special coming up. And then subsequently that story was written up by a freelance journalist, Miles Goslett. He couldn't get any of the national newspapers in Britain to print it, and he also then went to people like Private Eye. They wouldn't print it. He finally got it printed in the Oldie, and we've just heard in May this year that even the editor of the Oldie has now been sacked. So one wonders, if there is another Savile out there in the next story, where is it ever going to be heard?
Well, that's absolutely right. So you can see in that case, I mean, some people, one of the problems we face in Jersey is that, you know, the media kind of try to brush us aside, saying, oh, you're just a load of, you know, conspiracy theorists and so on, and there aren't these kind of cover-ups. But of course, the Savile case disproves that. You know, we can look at the Savile case and we can see absolutely, as you correctly just itemized, actual, real, evidenced, documented examples of the atrocities of this maniac being covered up, and covered up at the highest levels by our media institutions that we like to trust. So, yes, I'm afraid there will be other maniacs out there who have been covered up and who are still being covered up. I mean, for example, I have a tremendous amount of evidence about the cover-ups in Jersey, including an immensely detailed and important 94-page statement prepared by the former police chief, Graham Power. Now, I actually gave this document. I was the source. I obtained a copy and gave it to the BBC in Jersey, coming up for 3 years ago now, and the BBC in Jersey have flatly refused to report any of the very serious public interest issues which arise from that document. So this is how it unfolds. This is real. This is evidenced. It's happening now. The mainstream media going along with these kind of cover-ups. Jersey's bloggers are the only people who have stepped into the breach, really, where the Fourth Estate should be. And, you know, we face immense difficulties. We're unresourced. We're oppressed by the local authorities. You know, I've been prosecuted and even jailed for contempt of court under the so-called data protection law in Jersey for exposing a case that clearly was covered up, which involved an obviously mentally deranged male nurse clearly committing a series of murders in the Jersey hospital in 1999. Now, again, this is another whole different atrocity which has been covered up by the Jersey's mainstream media in collusion with Jersey's public authorities, which are supposed to protect people from these kind of dangers.
Well, Theresa May, the Home Secretary, a few weeks ago, after Norman Tebbit spoke out about this historic abuse, started two inquiries. One was a long-term one to report after the next general election, conveniently, and that was to be chaired by Elizabeth Butler Schloss. She, within a week, had resigned because it turned out that her brother, I think it was the Attorney General during when this abuse had been covered up back in the 1980s. And then there was another inquiry set up with Peter Wanless running it, looking into the lost, I think it was just, was it 140, I think, documents handed to the Home Secretary in the 1980s that had all been lost by the police, with allegations of the abuse of around about 20 public figures, people that everyday names that people would know, and that had all been lost. Peter Wanless is looking into that, but he is the former civil servant to Michael Portillo, who was himself accused of being involved in some kind of sex scandal cover-up when he was Minister of Defence. So one wonders if it's going to be possible at all to get to the bottom of this. There is, although, there is a campaign to get Michael Mansfield QC, someone who's rather more trusted and outside the establishment a little bit, to run the inquiry. So it seems that even the inquiries that the Home Secretary has put together, Stuart, immediately hit the buffers, and it's very difficult to see how someone like Wanless from the NSPCC, which Jimmy Savile was a major fundraiser for, of course, would be really trusted to run these inquiries properly.
It's difficult. I mean, I was frankly astonished when it was announced that Elizabeth Butler Schloss was going to be the nominee, as it were, the chair for the inquiry, and I knew immediately that it just wasn't going to happen and she would have to resign within weeks. It was simply that obvious. She was so conflicted from the outset, even assuming she did approach the investigation with good faith, she was so conflicted from the outset her position would have been impossible. So you have to wonder at the competency of the advice that was given to the cabinet ministers at the time, even made the selection. Quite how these inquiries are going to unfold and what they're going to uncover, I don't know. I mean, we're very used in the UK, aren't we, to all kinds of atrocities being kind of put on the back burner, as it were, by various public inquiries, which we end up having to have one, two, three or four public inquiries over a period of decades before we eventually get to the truth, like Bloody Sunday, like Hillsborough, and so on. I'm hopeful that the child abuse atrocities will be investigated much more effectively and more speedily than that. And one of the things I think that we have on our side that campaigners didn't have and civil society didn't have those years ago is the internet, our ability to communicate, our ability to make the news ourselves, and our ability to actually report the facts ourselves. I think that puts now immense pressure on corrupt authorities and authorities who are essentially under the control of certain lobbies. And, you know, I have to praise, for example, most strongly the work that's been done by independent journalists such as XRO News, who have done excellent investigative and campaigning work in the whole field of the child abuse crimes and the child abuse cover-ups. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult now for the customary British establishment to carry on maintaining the cover-ups, certainly in the United Kingdom. I think in the peculiar little quasi-jurisdictions of the Crown dependencies, where we simply have no functioning checks or balances at all, it's going to be more difficult, and we're campaigning, and we would like to hope that the authorities in London will eventually see they can't carry on protecting and associating with this manifestly lawless polity in Jersey, and that they've got to intervene and clean it up. So we're hoping that the Crown dependencies, such as Jersey, will be included in the national investigation. There will be an immense lobby from the usual suspects, City of London and the other lobbies, to keep Jersey out of it. But I think if we're looking at an era of responsible governance, then I think the authorities in London are going to have to clean up Jersey and bring Jersey into the fold of proper lawful checks and balances.
How high do you think this goes? Right the way up to royalty? Because it just seemed that they've been involved both with the Savile case and your case.
You know, I can't. I mean, obviously, there are some, you know, rather extreme and fanciful theories that sometimes float around about the royal family. I like to be fairly robust in respect of the evidence and the you know, analysis I bring to all of these cases. So, what I can say for certain is that the royal family has a very significant degree of power over the Crown dependencies. The monarchy, the monarch and the royal household, which is essentially all of the very wide and far-reaching range of offices that members of the royal family have under their control. The royal household does have a tremendous amount of power and influence over the Crown dependencies, far more so than the royal family and the monarchy does have in the United Kingdom. So certainly there has got to be some serious thought given as to how that power can be made more accountable and how a similar degree of accountability can be brought to it as has been in place in the United Kingdom via the Act of Settlement for some centuries now.
Okay, Stuart Siveray, former senator down in Jersey, thanks ever so much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And now I'm joined by Daphne Havercroft from South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group. Hi, Daphne. Welcome
Hello,
to the
Tony.
Politics Show.
Thank you.
We've come back to this week to talk particularly about Robert Francis and his Freedom to Speak Up review. Can you tell us what that is, please?
Yeah, it's a follow-on, really, from the public inquiry that he ran, which cost £30 million. But it's been requested by Jeremy Hunt, the Secretary of State, and he's asked Robert Francis to look at inhibitors for people being able to speak up when they see unsafe care.
Well, let's go straight away to hear from a doctor who's had all sorts of problems along these lines. His name's Raj Mattoo, and he himself has been blacklisted.
Many people have come to me, and there's evidence that firstly there is a form of listing. We could call it blacklisting if you want, but there is a list held by the Department of Health of certain types of clinicians that they would probably find disagreeable because they're too outspoken.
Now, that sounds immediately like a whistleblower's being blacklisted. Is this really going on, do you think, Daphne?
Yes, I'm sure it is. And I've seen in Bristol when doctors I know spoke up about what they regarded as unsafe care and they've either been silenced or driven away.
Well, let's hear a little bit more about Raj Mattoo. He's a cardiologist, by the way, his specific case.
It took 13 years, the prime years of my career and life from me. In essence, I raised concerns with the hospital management about the fact that patients were regularly put at risk and not provided optimal or best care. The response, as Jenny has told you, in her experience, is something I've experienced from speaking to hundreds of other whistleblowers who've sought my advice. There's a pattern of behaviour. There's a deliberate attempt to falsify allegations against the whistleblower, to discredit them and to try and isolate them as quickly as possible. And that's been confirmed to me, ironically, very recently after I won my case by a manager in the West Midlands Strategic Health Authority, who confirmed that when they're trained, they have sessions where directors of HR tell them to do that. And what they do is this deliberate attempt to distract attention from the safety problem, which is, after all, why all of us whistleblower, we're concerned so much about our patients and their safety that we feel we have to speak up, because we can't, our morals and our obligations don't allow us to continue accepting it, is that they then try and very quickly create this attempt to smear you, and then what becomes the main issue in the public eye and in the eyes of the agencies that are supposed to regulate our trust is the employment dispute they've artificially created. And as you say, it took me 13 years to clear my name, to be vindicated, and for being credited at last for properly and appropriately raising concerns about safety. And I'll give you an example of why it remains a serious issue today. Is one of the things I raised concerns about was an overcrowding policy in Coventry, where five patients were placed into bays designed only for four. 5 years after I had raised this in the West Midlands in Coventry, I discovered only 3 weeks ago that it continued at Midstaffs Hospital and patient deaths occurred. So I then discovered only a few weeks ago that all my efforts to raise these concerns appear to have been in vain, because managers not only decided to turn on me and attack me, but the patient safety issue that I had first raised seems to have been forgotten. And it commensurate with that is the fact that to date, neither myself nor the two senior nurses who raised those concerns about the patient we saw dying as a result of being overcrowded and the serious clinical incident for we submitted, we have still not to date been interviewed about the circumstances, and we are aware that the relatives of that patient have still not been interviewed.
Well, that is pretty amazing. Absolutely shocking. When I heard that on Five Live, I was completely gobsmacked, Daphne. The idea here being that he's raising concerns about patient safety, someone potentially dying, and then is hit with an employment issue, and the entire investigation into his original complaint about patient safety is then completely dropped and ignored. Nobody's interviewed about it, and nothing is done about it.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not just confined to how certain elements in the NHS treat their staff and make it a employment issue. It actually extends further. And as you know, last time I was on the show, I'd been removed from University Hospitals Bristol's public members list. And I was contacted by a foundation trust governor from another part of the country who saw that news item. He'd been elected by the public in his area to hold that trust to account, and he was asking questions, actually carrying out his public duty. This is, you know, someone volunteers, he doesn't get paid for this. He was asking questions that the trust board didn't like, and he was removed based on allegations that were never substantiated. And what I discovered was that the legal firm that the NHS used public money in advising the trust boards to remove him was the same one that was providing advice to University Hospitals Bristol to remove me. And I think one of the things that the Francis Review, and I hope it does this, is look at the role of legal firms being paid public money to silence whistleblowers, whether they are NHS employees or members of the public.
No, I mean, this sounds like sharp practice, business behaviour that's come from the business community. I mean, it's not necessarily the way to do public service. And it does strike me that the chairman of the University Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust is John Savage, who is a former boss of Business West, which was the business community organisation, and of course also a merchant venturer. So another business aspect to this. Do you think this is simply the case that these people are involved? I mean, these specific individuals, that is John Savage and Peter Rillett, are involved in actually bringing in a kind of sharp practice business culture, go-getting kind of attitude, so that if anybody in their employ that asks questions they don't like, they can then get rid of them?
I think with the business aspect of it, you get good businesses, you get bad business practice. It's the same in the public sector.
But this seems to be the worst possible kind of practice. Yeah. That is, when someone is bringing up a legitimate complaint, they're then bullied out and told, well, this is why I said at the top of the hour something about this idea of the bullying and secrecy and the kind of culture of shut your mouth and do what you're told.
Well, it's bad business practice, it's unprofessional, it's immoral, and it's unethical. And yeah, there are some business practices where that sort of behaviour is tolerated, and unfortunately the public sector, large swathes of it have been infected as well.
So this Robert Francis Freedom to Speak Up review does sound to me really, really crucial, important. Is it still running, and do you think it's going to actually make any improvements?
Yes, it's taking evidence until the 10th of September, and it is asking people to come forward.
And they can be anonymous if they want, can't they?
They can be anonymous. It can be patient and public groups as well. We've been encouraged to give evidence. My view is it's too early to say whether it's going to make a difference, because many people are putting in their faith in Robert Francis by speaking up to him. But the campaign group Patients First and also the BMA told Jeremy Hunt that they felt that this should be a public inquiry, and personally I agree with that.
What difference would that make then?
A public inquiry would, if it was conducted in a particular way, require people to give evidence under oath, and the chair of the inquiry could summon people, subpoena them to give evidence, and that's what Robert Francis did in the Mid-Staffordshire inquiry.
Well, let's just go back for a minute to Raj Mattoo's case, and that some of the reasons that this Robert Francis Freedom to Speak Up review is happening in the first place. What happens when a clinician brings up evidence that patients may be being put at risk or possibly even dying because of bad practices, and then a manager intervenes to squash that complaint? Surely that manager, in law, could possibly be responsible for the deaths of individuals and be prosecuted as a criminal themselves.
Yes, and there is the code of conduct for NHS managers, and they are all required to make their first duty patient safety, to protect patients.
But is that enforceable?
No, well, it is enforceable, but nobody ever enforces it. It's a disciplinary matter. And you mentioned earlier in the programme, Tony, about misconduct in public office. Very simple what it is. The offence is committed when a public officer willfully neglects to perform his duty, willfully conducts himself to such a degree as to amount of an abuse of the public's trust in them, and does it without reasonable excuse or justification. So I think one of the things that I would like the Robert Francis review to look at is why people are not being held to account under the code of conduct for NHS managers in the most serious cases. Why the criminal offence of misconduct in public office is not being applied to certain individuals.
Another horrific thing is the idea of human resources bosses going on courses on how to easily and quickly get rid of anybody that brings up any issues of patient safety.
Yes, and you've got to look at the role of the professional bodies in this. Many HR directors, both in the private and public sectors, are members of the Chartered Institute for Personnel Development, I think it is, and they have professional codes of conduct. So what are these professional organisations, which are covered by Royal Charter? They are supposed to act in the public interest. How come these professional bodies are not holding their members to account and bringing them to book under their codes of conduct?
What an excellent question. And also, we've got some good news, which is that the Care Quality Commission are going to be in town, aren't they? Looking at University Hospitals, Bristol Foundation Trust, North Bristol NHS Trust and Bristol Central GPs.
That's right, yes. They're planning to carry out some inspections between now and the end of the year. And on the 3rd of September, which is this Wednesday, the coming Wednesday, between 5 and 6:30 p.m., they have what they call a listening event in Bristol City Hall, when people can go along and actually find out more about what the CQC are going to be doing and also talk to the inspectors.
Well, this is good news, isn't it? Because at least there's avenues for people to go down, not necessarily phoning you up, Daphne, all the time. Yeah. If they've got concerns about patient safety across the city, we've got the Robert Francis Freedom to Speak Up review about people who are actually working in the health service, for them, and also obviously for people who know people who are working in the health service who may be too afraid to do it themselves, and then also this listening event by the Care Quality Commission. Can you just remind us of where and when that's on again?
Yes, it's Bristol City Hall on College Green, Wednesday the 3rd of September from 5 to 6:30 p.m.
Okay, Daphne Havercroft from South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, NATO, they are coming to Cardiff, to Newport. You may have seen the signs if you've been on the motorways. But Old Labour Oxford economist Martha Summers, this is a biggie, really, isn't it? It's the big conference, NATO's annual biggest summit, and they're coming just down the road.
They are, and the moment they're coming is a very important moment because they're probably going to be mainly discussing the war in the Ukraine and its possible escalation. And NATO is at a turning point in its affairs, and they're going to be coming very close to us to have their discussion. There will be protests and also conferences, counter-conference in Cardiff on Sunday, and a protest in Newport itself on Saturday.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen, I think he's Danish, isn't he? He's the Secretary-General of NATO, and which is supposed to, by the way, be a defensive treaty, so if somebody attacks Britain, actually crossing into Britain, then NATO is invoked, the North Atlantic Treaty, but it seems these days that they've got ideas a bit above their station, and they're going all around the world to places like Afghanistan to kick people in those countries.
Well, you might be surprised to find that the North Atlantic Treaty Organisation is operating in the Hindu Kush, which is about as far from the North Atlantic as you can possibly get on the planet without going to the moon. But there you are. Also, of course, the Ukrainian regime will be looking for honorary NATO membership. I believe they're going to have their representatives at this meeting, even though they're not members of NATO. And of course, the real danger here is that, just as in 1914, a series of rickety alliances are going to lead the world over the precipice.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who's speaking earlier today about the Ukraine.
Despite Moscow's hollow denials, it is now clear that Russian troops and equipment have illegally crossed the border into eastern and southeastern Ukraine. This is not an isolated action, but part of a dangerous pattern over many months to destabilize Ukraine as a sovereign nation. Russian forces are engaged in direct military operations inside Ukraine. Russia continues to supply the separatists with tanks, armored vehicles, artillery, and rocket launchers. Russia has fired on Ukraine from both Russian territory and within Ukraine itself. Moreover, Russia continues to maintain thousands of combat-ready troops close to Ukraine's borders. This is a blatant violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Well, there you go. He's the boss of NATO, Martin, and he's getting very annoyed. He's using all sorts of words which you wouldn't necessarily expect from normal diplomatic language, like blatant, hollow words, this kind of thing.
Well, yes, and in actual fact, a lot of this is proven wrong. I mean, how many times have we heard now that Russian troops have entered into the Ukraine? It's virtually every week we've been told this, and up to now, no evidence has been produced.
Radio, but what Rasmussen has produced, to give him credit, is a lot of satellite photos. I mean, we haven't seen satellite photos, incidentally, of the airliner when that was being attacked, possibly by a plane, possibly by a rocket launcher, but we have seen the satellite photos, obviously, NATO and the West do have these satellites scrutinising Ukraine constantly, so I was very surprised not to see any pictures of the plane, which I think some of the relatives would probably quite like to know a little bit more about. But we have seen what looks like pictures of Russian, maybe not, but units on the ground.
Yeah, well, actually, the satellite pictures are from commercial satellites, actually, not from military satellites. Well, there's a war of words going on. I mean, if the Russians were infiltrating military equipment and personnel into the Ukraine, it would only be a response to the infiltration of NATO into the West Ukraine.
Now, what evidence have you got for that?
Well, there is overwhelming evidence that, for example, let's put it this way, Western military forces... not mercenary military forces are definitely fighting with the Ukrainian army, and they're not doing that without having the nod from NATO. Also, of course, we're not hearing very much about what's going on in the East Ukraine, which is essentially an attack upon the population of the region, very similar to what happened in Gaza, but with a lot less coverage. And in Russia, of course, the coverage has been virtually wall to wall. So, of course, the popular opinion in Russia is very much in support of their government, whereas, of course, popular opinion in the West is actually rather lukewarm about the idea of going to war with Russia over the Ukraine. Don't forget that Donetsk and Luhansk both voted to secede from the Ukraine, overwhelmingly. And in fact, of course, and Russia, of course, has already annexed Crimea. Now, if the Russians wanted to annex Donetsk and Luhansk, they could have done so immediately. They could do so at any moment. The Russians could march in there because they've got overwhelming strength, and also they've got an air superiority. If they wanted to seize this territory, they could. But they haven't.
But then surely NATO would be then marching straight into Ukraine right up to the Russian border.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the point is that they're talking now about putting these so-called missile defence systems in place across Eastern Europe, which will then allow NATO to carry out a first strike against the Russian military. Now, the Russian general staff have actually probably been telling Putin to take a stronger line. But Putin, being a politician, has been trying. He met with Poroshenko in Minsk this week and said, look, let's try and do a deal on this. Let's get a ceasefire going and some negotiations. But Poroshenko knows that most of the gas which NATO wants is underneath the East Ukraine, and if the Donetsk and Luhansk are allowed some degree of autonomy or federalism within Ukraine, then the Western multinationals won't get their hands on it. Now, already thousands of civilians have died in horrific circumstances in the East Ukraine, mostly from random bombardments by the Ukrainian military, who is completely unprofessional military. They've also got far-right groups, basically militant formations of fascist volunteers involved in all of this, and also private oligarchs like Kolomoisky, who's got his own private army.
Well, I mean, to address Rasmussen and Poroshenko's claims about Russian troops in the east of Ukraine, I had quite a good look at this yesterday, and the only thing I could see is pictures of people that might be Russian troops, and all of the real, it seems, independent analysis is saying, well, they might be, but there's actually no real evidence that they are. But I come back to this question of what evidence do you have that NATO special forces or other NATO-related organisations, maybe just doing some kind of military support work or whatever, are actually on the ground in Ukraine? Because they don't appear to be.
Well, I think that's just wrong. I think there's lots of evidence to suggest that they
what
are.
What evidence? Can, tell
well,
us.
Well, I haven't got the internet in front of me, but let's put it this way. When you were on Russia Today with an American spokesperson. Oh, no, it was not Russia Today, it was Press TV, wasn't it? He was saying, well, of course, we've got our people in there advising the Ukrainian military. And if you think that the British Army is not in there advising the Ukrainian military on what to do and what not to do...
Well, it's one thing advising, another thing to have the soldiers,
well,
isn't it?
Well, indeed, but I mean, that's what all the Russians would say. We're giving help and advice to our colleagues in the Donetsk and Luhansk Defence Forces.
So what's NATO's involvement with the whole situation in Kyiv and the regime that's still there? Because there's been a political meltdown, hasn't there, in Kyiv?
There
so
has.
It does seem that the military have been left, the Ukrainian military, just sort of do what they want. And I imagine that they are working quite closely with NATO in that.
Well,
I would imagine that they will
be. I mean, they're coming to the meeting of NATO next week with a shopping list of things they want from NATO. So the idea that they're not cooperating with NATO is absurd.
Now, this is moving closer and closer to a NATO versus Russian standoff, and possibly even a shooting war, which could turn nuclear.
We've already got a trade war, which is probably going to bankrupt many of Britain's farmers, never mind shooting badgers, you're about to be put out of business by a trade war with Russia fought for Ukraine. I hope the people in Somerset are happy about
that. Yes, the EU are meeting at the weekend discuss it.
Now, let's come back to the very beginning of this process when a putsch, a violent coup, was carried out against the elected government of Ukraine, and it was triggered by the shooting by snipers of 100 people, many of them protesters, some of them police officers. And the evidence is piling up. It's been in the Daily Telegraph, it's been in the mainstream media, the quality media, that was actually carried out by the current regime. And the current regime will be working with NATO's intelligence services, the Gladio-style part of NATO's intelligence services, which carried out all kinds of attacks in Western
Europe.
Now,
everything seems to have gone rather quiet on the whole business of the MH17, the Malaysian airliner that disappeared over Ukraine. We've got the black boxes here in Britain, but no sort of developments there. It may be that there's something gone wrong with the analysis of the black boxes, because it's all gone quiet. So the other one thing that, I mean, I would point you to, particularly I've been looking at online, is to see the pictures of the aircraft itself. It does seem as if it was shot at either by a machine gun of some sort, maybe as it was coming down. It's got bullet holes in it.
Yes, and the Russian general staff gave a press conference where they showed their time-dated satellite images.
You can actually see the
which showed that there were two Kiev.
See the Russian radar, can't you, online?
Kiev regime planes shadowing the plane. Kiev denied that they had planes anywhere in the vicinity. The Russians just proved that they did.
There's been no Kiev radar and no Kiev transcripts or sound from the air traffic control conversations.
Yes, and of course, in Malaysia, the New Straits Times, the headline here, was M17 finished off with a guns kill with a picture of a Ukrainian aircraft shooting the plane down. Now, I think that the evidence is piling up that the Ukrainians shot down that plane as part of a power play to try and drag NATO into the war, and that in actual fact they're not coming out with any evidence because they know which way the evidence points. Now, if you say, well, NATO would, they wouldn't do that on their own. They'll have done that in coordination with NATO's intelligence services. NATO's intelligence services have a track record of being involved in provocational terrorism in order to get incidents going.
There is a little bit of
a
dispute.
Goes back a long
there
way.
Is a bit of a dispute if you look online though about the size of, because people have measured the bullet holes in the plane. Some say it's a 30mm cannon and others say a 20mm cannon. Well, if it is a 20mm cannon, that is a biggie, because the Russian planes that the Ukrainian Air Force have don't have a 30mm cannon. Only the NATO aircraft have that.
Well, indeed. And the other thing is that we've been told, so up to now, the story has been that it was a Buk missile, BUK missile, fired by the rebels, although there's no evidence that the rebels have got such missiles, although there is overwhelming. The Ukrainian army has several batteries of such
missiles. It must be absolutely awful for the friends and relatives of those that died in that plane to be treated in this way, really, to be told, oh, it was the other guys and we're not going to now really properly investigate what happened.
Well, you'd have thought if they had evidence they'd have come out with it, but the fact is that NATO bombed Bologna railway station in 1980. NATO carried out the Dortmund beer hall massacre. NATO carried out the Brabant massacres. There's overwhelming evidence through police investigations in Italy, Belgium and Switzerland that NATO carries out terrorist actions in order to provoke certain responses. And it looks to me like the shootings in the Maidan Square at the beginning, the massacre in Odessa and the shooting down of the plane were probably all masterminded by Western intelligence service, and that means CIA, MI6.
So one
that means our own people.
One does wonder whether this NATO descending on Newport over the river are actually our real leaders, the real bosses.
What will happen?
It's a massive fortress they're building around.
There's representatives of over 60 countries coming to this meeting, which includes all of the NATO members and the hangers-on. And what will happen when they get there is they'll be told what to do by their bosses, who are largely based in Britain and the US. And Britain has a big role to play in Syria and elsewhere. MI6 has been involved through the Gladio networks with the CIA and probably with the Israelis in all sorts of terrorist actions over the last 30, 40 years. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if they were still involved in such things. So let's go back to the shootings at the Maidan Square at the beginning. The evidence is piling up that it's the current regime who killed the
protesters. Let's actually go back to the early days of NATO, because Paul Hauser, who was an SS Panzer Corps general on the Eastern Front during World War II, and then after the war, he was the head of this organisation, HIAG, which is HIAG, which was the SS Veterans Association. He said the first meetings of NATO were actually put together from the international supporters of the SS.
Well, indeed, and of course, Reinhard Gehlen, who was eventually head of the West German intelligence services, had formerly been the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe. Now, what you've got is that NATO's track record is of one of anti-Soviet, very deep anti-Soviet, anti-Russian orientation, and also involvement in dirty tricks and psychological psychological warfare operations from the 1940s onwards, including assassinations of politicians and killings of random innocent people, as at Bologna and the Brabant massacres in Belgium.
And just today, we've heard from Big Brother, David Cameron, that we've got to be more afraid of Muslims. I'm just wondering whether this parallels the Nazis' demonisation and scapegoating of Jews.
Well, it's all psychological warfare techniques. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, has been on French TV, and he's been saying that the British officials approached him before the Arab Spring, saying, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. There's overwhelming evidence that the NATO intelligence services have been involved in arming and training ISIS. There are pictures on the internet, been on CNN, of John McCain meeting with al-Baghdadi, who's supposedly the head of ISIS. So both the Ukrainian fascist groups like Pravi Sector and Svoboda and ISIS, who are Muslim fascists, have an intimate relationship with the Western intelligence services, as I'm quite sure the Russian intelligence services well know.
OK, Martin. Well, that's all for this week. I'm off for 2 weeks. You'll have Billy Quain hosting the BCFM politics show for the next couple of weeks. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, who's Labour's member of the Mayor's Cabinet, assistant mayor, in fact, and responsibility for children and young people and education. And that's the Councillor for South Mead, Brenda Massey. Thanks also to former Jersey Senator Stuart Siveray, you heard earlier this hour, and Daphne Havercroft from South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, which takes you straight to the show and our archives and many links from each programme. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can follow me, and we'll be back this next week. I'll leave you this week with some music from Oh What a Lovely War, which was directed by Richard Attenborough, who died this week.
The choir will now sing What a Friend We Have in Jesus, as we offer a silent prayer for success in tomorrow's onslaught.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
Sky News Centre at 7. Interpol's issued a global missing persons alert for a 5-year-old boy taken out of hospital by his own parents. Asher King from Portsmouth has a brain tumour. Matt Steele has more.
Asher's dad and 6 siblings all boarded a ferry to France last night, his brother Naveed among them.
Hi Asher, we love you so much.
He addressed Asher directly in a YouTube video last month. Now it's the police appealing to his family.
Please take Asher to the nearest hospital immediately.
They're particularly worried about the battery in his feeding system.
If he doesn't receive urgent medical care, his condition will become life-threatening.
But police wouldn't be drawn on whether the parents' religion may have been a factor or why there was a 6-hour delay before doctors in Southampton called them.
Increasing violence from Islamic State extremists in Iraq and Syria has forced officials here to increase the terror threat level. It's now